Okay, so today on the Loopcast with me, I have Professor Howard French, who is the author of the book China's Second Continent: How a Million Migrants Are Building a New Empire in Africa. And this is part of our series on Africa. And when I read through the book, and this is what sort of why we wanted to bring Professor French onto the show is. It's really a unique book. If you are a student, if you're studying Africa or studying the politics of the continent, it's really interesting because it sort of looks at the relationship of China and the continent not through the lens of big business or not through the lens of military or intelligence involvement, but rather through the experience and through the eyes of the migrants, of people, of basically regular people who have moved to the continent and who have sort of started a new life. And you learn a lot, and you sort of the lens that Professor French creates, it gives you insights to what is the experience of a Chinese migrant on the continent, and sort of builds up into sort of insights into this larger phenomenon of Chinese involvement in Africa. It's, you know, it's definitely worth your time, and definitely if you are, you know, studying Africa, definitely something you should read. I want to start off with what was your inspiration to write the book? Because I was very fascinated by it because it's not a traditional political book, but it's very much, you know, through the lives and experiences of these various migrants, of various people who have come from China and settle down in Africa, whether it's Ghana, Mozambique, or whatever. What was sort of your inspiration or your rationale to sort of write this book?
Thank you very much, Sina. There's a rather long personal story behind this. I guess the very beginning of the personal story is when I was about to enter college. My first year in college, I visited Africa for the first time. And I've been involved with Africa really ever since, one way or another, and have remained involved as a journalist, as a traveler, as a thinker, even when I have not been in Africa physically or based in Africa, working in other parts of the world. I was for many years a correspondent for the New York Times, working in what used to fashionably be called the Third World, including Africa. And kind of midstream with my New York Times foreign correspondent experience, I was sent to East Asia, where I had never really worked before. And so I started working in East Asia in Japan in 1998. And I had an inkling, even back then, of something really interesting going on in terms of non-traditional parts of the world taking a very special interest in Africa. And the very first glimpse that I had of this was of Japan, which was activating an Africa foreign policy during my stay in Japan at the end of the 90s and very early in 2000s. And the Japanese government began organizing sort of summits and large gatherings with African leaders, which I sort of skirted the edges of as a reporter, but didn't do very much with. Then I moved in 2003 to Shanghai and worked in China for 6 years as a bureau chief there for the Times. And my office complex happened to be one of the first big international hotel and office complexes built in that city after China begins to open up. And so it was a favored place back then for visiting foreign leader delegations. And I could see literally from my office the arrival of African head of state delegations coming to visit Shanghai on part of their tours of China, typically after having gone first to Beijing. And I just began to notice in a casual way the increasing frequency of this and started to wonder, so what does this really all mean? This led me to eventually writing for the Times a series of articles based on travel in a few African countries about this new burgeoning relationship between China and the African continent. So that series ran in 2007. The next year, I left the Times and joined the journalism school at Columbia University, where I teach now. Soon afterwards, Atlantic Magazine asked me to take a follow-up look, to spend a little bit more time and to go further with this topic. And so I took a long overland trip in East and Southern Africa, from starting in Tanzania on the Chinese-built railway, built in the 1960s and 70s, from Dar es Salaam all the way through Tanzania, and then through much of Zambia, and then by car, I went from there into Southern Congo. And Chinese migration really wasn't the focus of that particular article, although I talked about it a little bit. But that travel experience really awakened me to the full extent of this phenomenon, which then later becomes the subject of my book. And, you know, so the Atlantic piece begins to get a lot of attention in Africa circles, in China circles, in publishing circles. And I was asked by various people if I'd like to write a book about this. I must say, initially, I was a little hesitant. I mean, I thought, so I've done a Time series here. I've done an Atlantic article. I like to keep changing my focus and doing different things. And I thought, well, do I really want to spend so much time as it takes to do a book on a topic that I've been working on like this for already in two significant ways? But I overcame the reluctance through the prodding of some generous people, including the fellowship that I got with Open Society, in part out of a sense of really responsibility to the topic. I am, you know, a lot of people have written on China and Africa, not necessarily migration, but the broad theme of China and Africa. And often they bring one of two kinds of backgrounds to the subject. Either they have a China background or an Africa background. Sometimes they have neither. They're just generalists. But in the best of cases, they usually either have a China background or an Africa background, and very, very rarely both. And I thought, okay, so look, I've spent my whole life involved with Africa. I've spent the last more than 10 years involved in East Asia. I speak Chinese. I think I have a good understanding of China as a very dynamic and changing society. How can I not write about this? And so that was pretty much the clincher for me that got me to undertake the book.
So I want to sort of get into the book now. And I want to start off maybe with giving a very general perspective, but let's start off with what are the sort of circumstances that, you know, causes people to migrate from China to Africa? I mean, give us a sort of sense of what is sort of promoting people to move from one country to a continent.
Mm-hmm. So in the mid-1990s, China began to make a bunch of very strategic decisions about its economic future. It had had a really good run of a decade or so after, a little more than a decade, after having opened up its economy to foreign capital. And China had basically taken off as a manufacturing center that was essentially doing outsourced labor for other sophisticated economies, you know, through industrial zone type activity. And the Chinese leadership in the mid-1990s said that however much this has fueled our takeoff, it's only going to take us so far. We really need a second leg to our approach to economic development. And so the Chinese leadership devises a strategy which they later in 1997 begin to call going out, in which they say we have to not just be the recipient of capital, but we have to be adventurers and explorers and people who we have to engage the outside world as much as possible on our terms. And so the Chinese leadership then identifies Africa as a strategic area for this kind of outward-looking focus. And the reason I think they chose Africa is because it seemed to be relatively neglected by the West, relatively uncompetitive in terms of international economic competition. And so this puts Africa on the map for Chinese people and Chinese companies, particularly state-owned construction and engineering companies, begin prospecting for contract work in Africa. And the Chinese state begins to fund them very generously. And so these Chinese building companies start sending over teams of ordinary Chinese people, laborers, to work on contracts, which could typically be 1 year or 2 year contracts to build a stadium or a port or an airport or a railway system or what have you. And so these ordinary laborers then start going in large numbers to Africa, and gradually a certain number of them in each case decides at the end of their contract that they like it where they are, that they see opportunity where they are, and that they're going to try to make a go of it right there on the ground in whatever African country they found themselves. So that was really the first element of this big thrust of migration. And what then subsequently begins to happen is that these, as some of these Chinese laborers begin to have success and to make money, and in certain cases actually to get rich, word of their success and word of their enterprise begins to creep back into China via social media, which is also exploding in China at the time. And this begins to create a second wave, or what I like to call the pull factor. It's a sort of phenomenon of emulation, where you hear that your neighbor, you know, who disappeared a few years ago to Africa, you know, you thought that that was an unthinkable thing at the time, and here, lo and behold, he has become rich. He owns farmland, or he owns a factory, he owns a fleet of vehicles, et cetera, et cetera. And the neighbor often will think, well, you know, that guy's not smarter than me. If he can make it in Africa, I can do it too. And so this pull factor then begins to kick off, and I think lead to vastly larger numbers of Chinese people going to Africa. And these are the sorts of people who, by and large, populate my book.
And, you know, following up in this sort of general sense, what do you see as the role of Chinese immigrants? Because, I mean, of Chinese migrants, because it seems like in the book you know, there's very much the hustle and bustle sort of businessman, you know, sort of, you know, he's got a house outside the, you know, way out in the fields. He's buying up property, and then you also highlight, you know, people who are building clinics. And so, in a sense, I mean, what are some of the roles and sort of the sort of engagement of people in Africa, of Chinese migrants in Africa? I mean, you know, is it just purely economic and business, or could we, you know, is there more humanitarian and sort of, you know, being involved in that sense?
Well, you mentioned clinics, and there are indeed at least one or two examples of people who opened clinics in my book. But I would have to stress that the people we're talking about, these migrants, are economic migrants. They're driven by a sense of Africa. This is unusual for a Westerner to hear, because our depictions of Africa are so consistently narrow and negative. But these are people who are driven by a vision of Africa as a place of wide open opportunity, of space, of land, of need for investment, and of potential profit. And so almost all of these people, including the people who open these clinics that I write about, are driven by a sense of economic, you know, seeking their economic future. Sectorially, I sort of broke my migrants up into three different groups. There are people involved in industry, but typically small industry, light industry. They're individual entrepreneurs. The second category is people who are involved or become involved in agriculture. And then the third sector is people who are involved in commerce. I think the beginning of your question was, what is their role? And this is really a very hard thing to suss out. The working title for my book prior to publication was Haphazard Empire. And the reason I liked that title is because although the Chinese state kicked off this big wave of migration through the going out policy and by encouraging state firms to go out and compete for business in Africa, the fact is that I don't think that the Chinese state had any idea at the beginning of this, of the extent to which this migratory wave would take. And they have, even in a day-to-day sense now, very little control over the activity of these migrants. And so these are free players in a way that I think is strange and unusual and maybe even uncomfortable to a certain extent for the Chinese state.
So, I mean, in that sense then, does Beijing have a policy towards the migrants? Is it as, you know, you called it a sort of haphazard empire. I mean, is it really, I mean, is there a policy? Let's start there.
Well, so yes, I think there is a policy. The state has not retracted its going out slogan or emphasis. And so even if this quickly began to lead to things that were unforeseen by Beijing, and even if it has made Beijing sometimes uncomfortable, Beijing has not repudiated this. And I think Beijing recognizes that it's too late to sort of put the cat back in the bag. And so Beijing is, you know, struggling as best as it can in an improvisational way to try to channel the energies of these people and to try to maximize the profit from the point of view of the Chinese state of this huge migratory presence. And I think that there are potentially very large payoffs for the Chinese state, that these migrants are creating all kinds of networks that all flow back to China of commerce, of finance, of migration, of culture, and you know, all of these things can be subsumed somehow, one way or another, under the sort of fancy slogan of soft power. And if things go well, by and large, with these new communities in Africa, then I think Beijing has come to surmise that this sort of will benefit its soft power in the future in Africa and more broadly in the world.
I want to sort of examine, before we sort of look at the sort of migrants, their political beliefs, in contrast to Beijing's, in using the sort of going out policy and the rhetoric of the going out policy, it's, describe the rhetoric for us. I mean, is this rhetoric and this framing in pure economic terms? Because in your book, you make a comparison to Manifest Destiny. And a part of Manifest Destiny, if I remember my history correctly, was it wasn't just about, you know, at least, you know, the policy was, you know, to grab land and to expand coast to coast. But in its rhetoric and in its construction, it was very much about religion and about invoking social themes and sort of, you know, creating a city on the hill and a more perfect union, so to speak. So I'm sort of curious. In the rhetoric and the sort of framing of the going out policy, you know, does the government in Beijing, are they invoking sort of a, you know, social themes, themes of religion, or is it really just, you know, you can make money by leaving the country, so to speak? I mean, I'm simplifying it, but, you know, what are some of the more social themes and social ideas within that rhetorical construction?
Sure. I mean, one could say very broadly that the ideology, the sort of ideology of daily life in China, if you will, since Deng Xiaoping, in beginning in the 1980s, has been, as far as the common people are concerned, keep your mind out of politics. Politics is the affair of the Communist Party and of the higher instances of the state. Seek your fortune. There's a very famous slogan that's attributed to Deng Xiaoping. He may or may not have ever said this, but it's always been attributed to him, which says, to get rich is glorious. And so the ideological thrust that accompanies this going out policy, as far as it is directed to ordinary people, is very much about fortune seeking. I use the term Manifest Destiny only as a title of a chapter. I don't really develop this as a comparison between the historical Manifest Destiny of the United States and anything happening with China and Africa today. The point I'm trying to make in using that term as a chapter title is the sense of entitlement that I have encountered very often among these Chinese migrants, that once they've pulled up stakes in China, they've scraped together every bit of savings that they have available to them. Sometimes they've even borrowed money. They arrive in Africa and they struggle to get a toehold there. They get a piece of land, they open a business, they do whatever they can to get going. And very quickly, many of these people begin to feel a sense of entitlement. They feel that the sacrifices and struggles that they've undergone to reach this point of their life entitles them to their position in Africa and to fortune in Africa. And I'm trying to say this as objectively as I can. Oftentimes, the people in whose midst they plunge, meaning Africans, don't necessarily see this the same way, and one can understand that. At the same time, if you put yourself in the shoes of a Chinese migrant who has made these life-changing decisions, you can see why a sense of entitlement might quickly arise. These are frontier people, frontiersmen, if you think of American Westerns, you know, the kind of entitlement that accompanied the move, the push of white people typically into Indian lands in the western parts of the United States. They felt that they were making great sacrifices and you know, that nothing should be allowed to stop them, including the fact that Indians had traditionally always lived on those lands. you know, one can condemn this historically and make even a moral, ethical judgment about it, and at the same time, understand the personal perspective behind that kind of mindset.
So I want to get into maybe comparing sort of the politics and the political beliefs of these migrants versus somebody in Beijing. I mean, it almost seems that as a migrant, I mean, the sense I got from reading the book was suddenly you're thrust into the frontier life and you have a lot more freedom. And I define freedom loosely as freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom of whatever. And, you know, compared to sort of, you know, to China and its sort of tight grasp on the internet, communications and expression. I mean, you know, what are the sort of differences between political beliefs, between the migrants you encountered and interviewed versus sort of, you know, people in Beijing, people in mainland China?
Well, you see, one of the most jarring things for me when I first arrived in China as a reporter in 2003 was, you know, we have, as outsiders, very often this view of China as a very controlled place, as a place of authoritarianism and censorship. And indeed, those features of Chinese society are real. And by the comparison to the experience of your typical American, significant and dramatic. But what was jarring to me arriving there is how easy it was, you know, once allowing for the language factor, to get Chinese people to speak to you about their feelings and to open up about any number of things. The difference between the Chinese who I got to know in 6 years working in China and the Chinese I got to know in a year of reporting this book on the ground in Africa is that the people who, these typically ordinary people, these laborers and people drawn by the pull factor that I've described, now have the added benefit of perspective of distance. They're no longer plunged into the daily realities of China where, you know, you have a resignation to certain things and, you know, if you're from that class, it's the only life you've ever known. Now they're in a place where the air is clean, where there's wide open spaces, where there's typically nobody following you around or closely monitoring your speech. You know, fountain, if you will, of expression about any manner of things, from the proliferation of or ubiquity of corruption in China to the merits of democracy to, you know, comparing. About the future of different parts of the world, I was always struck by the impact that this perspective of distance had on the way these typically very ordinary people were able to think about their lives and of their place in the world.
As a political class, I mean, are these migrants unified? I mean, it seems like, you know, is there ever a chance that you would have, you know, migrants who come back to China and demand these similar freedoms? Or is the cleavages within this you know, migrant group is so far in between that really you wouldn't ever have a chance of a unified sort of polity? You know, describe sort of, I mean, the political cleavages and unities within migrants themselves, within this group itself.
So, I mean, there's just... just very simply, I often divided the migrant communities that I met into two different groups. There were those who remained relatively close to the Chinese state and via the Chinese embassy and whatever the country it was. And there were those who just simply struck out on their own and very often wanted as little to do as possible with the Chinese state and with the Chinese embassy. And I would say that this second group was by far, in my experience, the larger of the two groups. In regards to the other piece of your question about whether any sort of return movement of people like this to China could somehow impact Chinese society, there has been a view in place in the West for a generation now that as China opens up, And as Chinese sends, you know, by now millions of people overseas to study in the West and various other places, and now you have this large migratory experience in Africa and migratory experiences in other places, that gradually this is going to sort of have a rebound effect on China and change Chinese society. I see very little evidence that this has actually taken place in any politically significant way. You know, China is, after all, a country of 1.4 or 3 billion people that has, you know, a very strong and consolidated popular culture and political culture, and has, as a sort of political system, very effective means for monitoring and channeling speech and controlling the news. And so, you know, the idea that a few million people could trickle back into China and change the place, although tempting, is not borne out, I don't think, in terms of the reality of China as a country.
Then let me pose the question this way. How do mainlanders view this migrant class then? You know, is it a positive view? Is it sort of a negative view? You know, how do they view folks who are going to Africa and sending back money, or going back to Africa and never really coming back? I mean, is this migrant class big enough to have sort of an impact of, you know, in mainland China?
I think by and large it's invisible to the general population in mainland China. However, having said that, I think one can create a certain hierarchy of prestige in the Chinese experience. The people who made it in China, who make it in China, and there are a great number of people, you know, China has seen the creation of a huge amount of wealth in the last generation, and there are lots of billionaires and millionaires in China now. The people who make it in China, within Chinese society, I think, generally tend to have the highest prestige, and are emulated and adulated and celebrated the most. Then you can begin to talk about people who left China, but for the most part not to return. Chinese who emigrated and then made it. You know, if you're going to emigrate from China and make it, I think the next circle of prestige for people back in China are people who make it in the West, particularly in the United States, secondarily in Europe. For people in the mainland, in general, the idea that you would go to Africa to make it is still a very much a minority perspective. In other words, I think China has sent not 1 million but 2 million people to Africa in the last decade. But 2 million people is a speck of hair in the vast soup of Chinese society, and so the idea that, you know, you would go to Africa to make it is still, for most Chinese people, a peculiar kind of perspective. Why would you do that? You know, maybe and I'm speculating here, but my guess is that the mainstream, if the mainstream of Chinese society stopped to think about this at all, they would probably say to themselves something like this: oh, those people couldn't make it in China. Parenthetically, I should add, that's true. They didn't have the wherewithal or the smarts or the resources to get to the United States or to Europe to make it. They settled on Africa. And maybe the follow-on thought for some of these people, rightly or wrongly, probably mostly wrongly, is poor them.
So maybe you want to pivot a little. And in your book, you do set up scenes where, you know, we do, as the reader, we do get to see the Chinese migrants sort of interacting with politics, African politics, either in Ghana, Mozambique, or wherever. So I'm sort of curious, you know, in your experience and your research, you know, I'm going to sort of pose this broadly and we can get into more details, you know. In what sort of society and what sort of country do these migrants flourish? I mean, are we talking about sort of the more sort of democratic end, you know, in sort of countries transitioning to democracy? Or do they flourish in more authoritarian, or is it really sort of, it really depends. And sort of, it's not so much the form of government, but rather, you know, the economy and sort of filling in gaps in the economy.
I have a hard time making a general sort of conclusion about this. I have a very strong bias, which I will just own up to up front, towards democracy as a sort of social norm. And I have a very strong belief based on, you know, a lifetime of work in Africa that democratic societies, relatively more democratic societies in Africa, will work out their problems better and have better fortunes or fates, or destinies, than relatively less democratic societies. I want to add, having sort of posited my ideology right up front, I think this last thing, observation, is not essentially an ideologically based idea. I think that you can observe objectively that relatively democratic states in Africa have done better than relatively undemocratic states. Having said all of that, I don't really see a particular pattern in terms of the success or draw that Africa exercises on Chinese migrants based on democracy versus non-democracy. And, you know, I use the example of Ghana, of Chinese migrants getting involved in, you know, kind of a form of wild, very environmentally destructive wildcat mining for gold, where they're doing alluvial mining, meaning basically in open stream beds, for gold nuggets, put chemicals like mercury into the soil to separate the gold from other materials. And here you have one of the most democratic states in Africa, Ghana, that was completely unprepared for this and continues to struggle to find a way to regulate this activity, to control the inflow of Chinese migrants and to control their behavior on the ground once they get there, which is, you know, not just environmentally destructive, but involves typically a lot of corruption, payoff to local officials in order to have them turn a blind eye to what they're doing or to gain access to land where they can do this kinds of mining.
So, I mean, in this sense, I mean, when we talk about politics, I mean, you have the first generation of migrants, and then you have the second generation. So the first generation, I'm assuming, is Chinese. They're from mainland China, but then the second generation is sort of building into the country and sort of marrying their way, you know, marrying somebody in Ghana, having, you know, children. So, I mean, you know, how do we think about this in terms of generations? You know, do we expect sort of these migrants to stop being migrants and start becoming political groups onto their own and sort of, you know, for lack of a better word, natural to the political scene?
This is a big unknown, a tremendous wild card, and I think one of the great questions going forward in terms of this relationship. I call it a relationship, but it's really a bunch of relationships between China and a large number of African countries. And this experience is really too fresh to know what's going to happen in the future, what sort of political implications it has for China to have its citizens and what people who will become its former citizens, meaning permanent migrants to other countries, in such large numbers in the African environment. My hunch is that, that China will not relinquish its hold on these people so willingly, and that China will make various claims to the safety and protection of these people and of their interests, meaning property and investments, going forward, and that this poses a big challenge to China in terms of its global foreign policy. Rhetorically, this has never been true to the letter, but rhetorically, China's foreign policy has always been based on the notion of non-interference in the affairs of other states, the internal affairs of other states. Even though that's never been literally true in every instance, I think that the proliferation of migrants like this and the growth of their interests in various places, interests which, as I've suggested earlier, tend to redound well to China itself, will draw China down the road of greater intervention, greater proactiveness, greater interference in the affairs of other states, including perhaps some of the kinds of imperial behavior that we've seen with the United States and Britain and various other powers in the past.
That's interesting to me. I mean, I mean, is this sort of, I hate to use this word, colonialism? I mean, is it sort of leading to not only China being sort of more of a presence on the continent, but sort of being interfering and sort of engaging in less than positive ways? I mean, is this, I mean, what can we expect from Beijing in terms of engaging the continent and sort of being involved with this migrant population?
Well, I've used the term empire in the title of my book, obviously, and I don't think that colonialism is the recipe, really, that China is going to pursue in Africa, whether it's explicitly, mindfully or not. But I think neocolonialism, which is quite a different thing from colonialism, is something to very much be on the lookout for. Neocolonialism is an expression of a kind of imperialism, and imperialism changes form, if one studies history, changes form all the time. History has seen lots of different kinds of imperial experiences. They go from frank and explicit colonies, such as the West had in Africa and other places, beginning in the late 19th century and running through the middle of the 20th century, to spheres of influence that were very sort of informal and had blurred boundaries, to concessions, which is an imperial approach that the West took toward China itself, carving up China but not governing it in a colonial way, to the neocolonialism referred to by Kwame Nkrumah in the 1960s, the first president of Ghana, where he said basically the West had withdrawn from Africa in terms of governing Africa in the classic sense, because that was no longer needed nor profitable, that the West could exploit Africa in a way that was highly beneficial to itself at greatly reduced cost by not administering Africa, by having local elites administer Africa on its behalf, and simply taking advantage of economic relations that were greatly advantageous to the West. And I think this points a bit to what one might expect in China, China has set up a series of economic patterns in Africa that all redound tremendously well to China, that may benefit some local elites in Africa, but can be questioned on a larger level of whether this is really these relations are really in the broader national interest of these African countries. And so if this pattern takes root and is pursued by China, then I think what we begin to talk about is a kind of neo-colonial relationship.
So I want to sort of pivot again, and I want to compare U.S. versus Chinese foreign policy when it comes to Africa. Because I find this rather interesting. I mean, in my mind, while I was reading your book, I constructed sort of a timeline of sort of comparing the events that were going on in the book and the events you describe in the book with sort of U.S. involvement in Africa. And it sort of piqued my interest because, you know, you follow a timeline from 2000, let's just say 2005 to now. And it almost seems there's a very stark contrast between Chinese foreign policy towards Africa and U.S. foreign policy. So my question is, in terms of Chinese foreign policy, you know, what do we ever expect to Beijing to sort of take a harder turn and tackle the same problems that the U.S. has sort of tackled, meaning counterterrorism, drug interdiction, and, you know, broader issues, you know, of dealing with, you know, military and defense issues? Or is this sort of, you know, as you sort of laid it out in the beginning, you know, Africa is very much an economic issue for China and nothing more, that it really, you know, it's not going to really engage in defense issues and counterterrorism issues like the United States does?
Mm-hmm. China is presently already the largest contributor to UN peacekeeping forces of any country in the world. And if I'm not mistaken, the biggest number of those peacekeeping forces are actually present in Africa. But I think for the time being, this is the sort of limit in terms of China's appetite for intervention, direct intervention in African political circumstances, that China is not really seeking at present to expand in a bilateral way. That doing this sort of thing, peacekeeping under the aegis of the United Nations, is one thing. Intervening directly in African conflict, in terrorism, in security of one kind or another, is something that I think the Chinese state would like to avoid, at least for the time being. I think there are a number of good reasons for that. One reason is that there's a view of recent global history that I think is rather persuasive, which says that China has done rather well, has done very well as what's often called a free rider on sort of the international security infrastructure that is underpinned by the United States, by American imperialism. And that, rather than having to extend itself in very costly ways around the world to, protect its interests or expand its interests, China can think very opportunistically about simply benefiting from the way the United States extends itself and expends its resources to maintain a kind of very imperfect, but a kind of global peace. This is all beginning to change. I think China is in its own immediate neighborhood, meaning East Asia. China is beginning to think very actively about ways that it can amend or even recreate the regional security infrastructure and to emerge as the principal player, and some would even say hegemon, in East Asia. And this is what's behind the conflicts with Japan in the East China Sea and with a variety of Southeast Asian countries in the South China Sea. This is all the topic of the book that I'm now working on, by the way, The Future of Chinese Power. But in Africa, I think Africa being as distant as it is from China, the Chinese would prefer for the time being simply to allow the international security infrastructure or architecture handle the security problems of Africa. And, so this, and given the fact that the United States very much has a security-driven policy toward Africa, that, for a very long time that would seem to be, other than health and disease, which also have, from the perspective of Washington, also have a security component, security would seem to be the only thing that that the United States sees in Africa. And so the Chinese have been, I think, happy with that, to let the United States be the ones who worry about security in Africa, while China thinks about how to make money in Africa and avoids having to spend its own money in underpinning security in Africa. And I think this is probably the pattern we're going to see for the time being. Their unexpected crises could, of course, change things. There was a huge Chinese evacuation from Libya when Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown. This points to how events don't always coincide with plans. But the Chinese avoided direct intervention in Libya. They simply pulled their people out.
So, what is sort of the flexibility in Beijing's policy towards Africa? Because it seems like you pointed out the evacuation of Chinese citizens in Libya, but now we have sort of this Ebola crisis that's going on, this pandemic. I mean, is the Chinese government satisfied with, letting the United States, hold, control the security situation? I mean, it's the CDC, the United States sort of leading the reaction towards this Ebola pandemic. It's the United States doing security in the Horn of Africa and France doing security in the north of Africa. I mean, is sort of China, I mean, where is the flexibility? Does it have flexibility to sort of increase its resources and increase its sort of security footing, whether that's physical, whether that's medical or whatever on the continent? I mean, do you get that sense that there is flexibility, or is it really sort of static strategy?
Well, I think there is a great deal of flexibility. I think that the overall stance of China toward these questions is just like I described it, that we, meaning China, we would like to sort of have a standoffish position toward conflict in faraway places. We'll let the international system take care of that. We'll let the United States take the lead in making arrangements for peace and peacekeeping and things like that. And we'll feed into this via the United Nations. However, what we've seen, and the Libyan evacuation is one example of this, another example is in South Sudan, is that where China sees its interests being sufficiently important, China can, in the margins of this overall policy, take exceptional actions. And the exceptional action in South Sudan, I think, is that China has become quite a player in the politics of that country. And in, with, you know, this is a country that is sort of a brand new country that has recently plunged back into civil war. China has become a very big player in terms of the internal politics of that country and in terms of the security of that country. China is one of the biggest investors and consumers in and consumers of South Sudanese oil. And China is being very creative as it improvises in ways to secure its interests in South Sudan's oil that it's invested in so heavily.
Okay. I think you've answered all my questions. But I want to sort of end our interview with one question, and that's, it comes from one of our listeners. If, you know, if a policymaker was to read your book, you know, whether that's President Obama or somebody in the Senate, you know, what's the one thing that you want them to take from your book when it comes to, you know, either Chinese foreign policy towards Africa, towards understanding Chinese migrants in Africa? What is, you know, if a policymaker reads your book, what is sort of the one or two things that you want them to take away from it?
Sure. The thing I would say is that people wrongly imagine in the United States that China is our, you know, head-to-head rival in Africa, that China is our enemy or implacable competitor in Africa, and that anything that China, any ground that China gains in Africa comes at our expense. I don't really believe that. China and Africa and the United States occupy very different niches in the global economy. And much of the business that China is doing in Africa is not business that the United States structurally is particularly geared for doing or for being terribly interested in. The thing that China has done that the United States has not done, and which American policymakers really need to wake up to, is realize that Africa is not a one- or two-dimensional place, a place of humanitarian disaster and security problems, but that China, that sorry, that Africa is this vast economic realm, 1.1 or 3 billion people, that's going to be 3 billion or so people by the end of this century, that Africa is a place with middle classes larger than the middle class of India, that Africa is the fastest growing continent in the world, that Africa is the fastest urbanizing place in the world, that Africa has, this incredible youth bulge of people who are very, very much plugged into the global culture, and that this creates an enormous opportunity for the United States, not only an opportunity to do good, which is a strain of American thought about the world, even though we are hypocrites very often, that we also do bad, like anyone else, very often in the world, but there's an opportunity to do good for oneself, meaning that the United States can find ways to do good by plugging into all of these positives in Africa that I've highlighted, but it can also find ways that are enormously profitable for itself in Africa. And that China has realized this stunningly, and the United States, which has a far more consistent and longstanding relationship with Africa going back decades, for its own peculiar reasons, the United States has failed to see this, that we are stuck in a one- or two-dimensional view of Africa, and it's not only bad for Africa, but it's bad for the United States.
So before we sign off for the night, give us something to think about, for the audience to think about. It's been a great interview and very informative, but, you know, give us that one last, you know, idea for us to chew on before we sign off.
Well, that's such a broad question. I'm not really sure how to enter into it, but I guess what I would encourage listeners to do is to think skeptically about what you read about Africa. I think that the press has, and I'm part of the press, and I accept my piece of the blame here. I don't say this as simply as the position of the lesson giver. But the press has a lot to answer for, with the American press, in the way that it is written about and conceived of Africa for a very long time. And self-examination is really overdue by the press. The American press is a part of the problem of why the United States has failed to understand Africa in terms of opportunity and failed to find other ways to engage Africa and to realize this relationship in more than two dimensions. But we don't need to wait, as you don't need as listeners, to wait for the press to sort of come around or to see the light. You as listeners can find a way to engage yourselves with Africa. Africa is, you know, in some ways, I would say, the most dynamic part of the world today, changing so rapidly before your eyes, before one's eyes. And you would do yourself as a listener, if you're not already someone who deals with Africa in a real and concrete way, to find a way to engage with Africa individually. Don't wait for the country to do it. Don't wait for the press to tell you it's okay or that there's interesting life there or interesting things to be done. Get on an airplane and go yourself and become involved with Africa, and you will be rewarded, I think, immensely.
Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Sina. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. That book, for those listening, it's China's Second Continent, How a Million Migrants Are Building a New Empire in Africa. And that's Howard French. Make sure we'll have a link up when we post this show. Just make sure to check it out. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sina.
Bye.